I'm going to wash that man right out of my hair. It's time for the Zaftcast. I'm host Scott C. How you doing, folks? At the end of August, we are rapidly approaching the fall season. And man, have we got a slate of guests for you this fall season on the Zaftcast. But more on that as the weeks go on. First and foremost, a little update and information for you from the Sundress Academy for the Arts. Kicking it off this week, this episode 36, with a wonderful notice about the 2015 Fall Nonfiction Writing Retreat happening at Firefly Farms, the home of the Sundress Academy for the Arts, just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. There has been such an overwhelming response to the fiction workshop retreat and the poetry writing workshop retreat that took place this summer, both of them, and of course the poetry one, this was the second annual, that they've added a third, and it is for creative nonfiction, and it is going to be a wonderful thing happening this October 16th through the 18th, that is a Friday through a Sunday, a three-day, two-night camping extravaganza, just like the other retreats, except this one is focused on creative nonfiction, as I said. Great time also to do this, because it's going to be nice fall weather in the Smoky Mountains of Appalachia there in Tennessee, and I can tell you from being at Firefly Farms myself in the past, I cannot imagine what it looks like with the hills just on fire with color and the crispness in the air. It's got to be awesome. And no, I did not say Christmas. I said crispness. So leading the retreat are two guests that have been on the Zaftcast, actually. The one and the only, Sarah Einstein and T.A. Noonan. They have both appeared on the show here this year, and you can catch them both in the same place at the Creative Fiction Nonfiction Writing Retreat. That is happening, as I said, October 16th through the 18th. For tickets and more information, you can visit the Sundress Academy for the Arts, the SAFTA website, by going to sundressacademyforthearts.com and clicking on programs/events at the top of your screen, and you can learn all about that. You can also visit sundresspublications.com for more info, and of course, you can always shoot us a message here at the SAFTAcast through our Facebook page or on Twitter at SAFTAcast for more information. Now, speaking of SAFTA projects, and speaking of former guests, T.A. Noonan was just the most recent guest on one of our sibling programs, the SAFTA Cookbook, which is a video series hosted by former guest on this program, Darren Demery, where he sits down with an author, they cook a recipe together, and then they sit and have a conversation about writing and food. It is truly a great thing, and you can find all the episodes for free on YouTube if you search SAFTA Cookbook, but you can also find episode links as well as recipes for the guests, as well as more information such as who's on the next one. You can find that by going to sundresscookbook.com and finding all the information there. That is sundresscookbook.com. Check it out. It is a great series. I have watched all three episodes, and I think it's fantastic, and I know you'll enjoy it too. On to today's program, episode 36, we have the one and the only Sarah Chavez on the program, a West Virginia poet, but also an awesome human being, and we get into a lot of good stuff. As you may know from the preview to this episode, we've got some great stuff to talk about. Turns out we're both movie buffs. Turns out we also really love coffee and desserts. So settle down with your own favorite cup of coffee, your own favorite dessert, and settle in for a great time here as Sarah and I get into it, talking about movies, especially what makes stop-motion macabre movies so interesting. That and more right after the theme song. Sarah, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
I'm excited you're here. So I always start off the show here, as often, with the burning question that is on everyone's mind. You ready?
Okay, I'm ready.
What do you think is the saddest food that someone could eat for breakfast?
Oh, that's a good question. Oh, the saddest food. Oh, man, I love breakfast. That is my, like, hands down favorite meal. And in my like low times when I don't have the thing I want for breakfast, I've been known to be very sad. I think maybe the saddest thing for breakfast might be, I know other people like this, but I think it might be leftover dinner, like leftover Chinese food. It's sad to me because you just had it and your refrigerator is so bare, or you have so little time that you couldn't muster up something breakfast related. That, you know, so it's really, it's like that's a sign that you have given up on your morning already. Your morning has already begun as a shadow of your previous evening.
I think the saddest thing I could see someone eating for breakfast would be a can of cold pasta.
Oh, in a can. That's
Yeah.
disgusting.
I agree. You know, just like they just open the can of ravioli and just start eating. Don't even bother heating it up. They just eat it.
Oh, yeah. I have to say, I've never done that. Have you had the sad breakfast?
No, I have not, thankfully.
Oh,
I subscribe to the philosopher's breakfast, a pot of coffee and a half a pack of cigarettes, you know?
awesome. I'm definitely with the full pot of coffee. Tired of it.
You're addicted to coffee, then.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
How do you take your coffee?
I actually really only drink coffee in three modes. In the mornings, I usually just have black coffee, and because I'll make it at home usually and take it with me somewhere. If I have to like leave my house early, I'll stop and get a latte somewhere, like a soy latte with nothing in it, no sugar or no vanilla or anything. And then every once in a while, if I want like an afternoon pick me up, I'll get something a little sugary, like a caramel macchiato or one of those like ridiculous dessert coffees, seasonal specific dessert coffees from Starbucks or something. But 85 to 90% of my coffee consumption is black coffee.
Do you find that caffeine really doesn't do much for you during the course of a day?
I do think that it is primarily psychological. It definitely wears off. I feel like I am definitely like in the morning, if I don't have it, I'm very cranky and a little like scatterbrained. But like once I hit like late morning, early afternoon, I'm kind of like, oh, more coffee sounds pretty good. 'Cause like I feel tired again. Or I just want it. But in the evening, I've noticed, and this is sad, but now that I'm, entering into my mid-30s, I can feel like if I have a lot, like if I have espresso after like 4 p.m., it'll affect my sleep that night. Like I'll just it'll make keep me from going to sleep when I would normally go.
I too had to institute a coffee cutoff point during the day. So it's like around 8 p.m. No more, otherwise I will be up late.
Oh, see, yours is good. You get all the way until 8 p.m. I'm jealous of your coffee cutoff.
Well, I'm not a big fan of espressos. I just
Ah.
prefer regular coffee, but I'll do two, three pots a day.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even the caffeine. For me, coffee is the drink of sociability, the drink of work, the drink of life.
Absolutely. I actually had my first cup of coffee with my grandfather. It's my mom's father, and he was just like the coolest, smartest person I knew. He was like this really self-educated, kind of atheist agnostic who kind of just like said something different than what everyone else told me. And he drank a ton of coffee. And when I was staying with them, when I was, I think I was probably about 11, we had this special bond and like we were the only ones, I think, awake. And he said, I think you're old enough now and this is an important time for you to learn how to drink coffee. And I was like, oh, okay. And so he poured me like half a cup of coffee and he put some milk in it. And he said, until you're 15, you should drink some milk in this. But then only like serious coffee drinkers drink black coffee. So that's healthier for you. Like once you're a little bit older, that's how you have to drink your coffee. And I did. I mean, I would only drink it when I was with him until I was like 14 and started like sneaking out to cafes and stuff at night, and then I would have some sort of like sugary drink then. But it was definitely like this is what smart people drink. This is what poets and writers and artists and movies drink. This is like an American drink.
I was told it's the drink of radio hosts.
Oh, why is that?
It's from Welcome to Night Vale, I think. They say coffee is the blood of the DJ. And I can understand that. It keeps you going. It keeps you wired. But for me, it was about diners. And it seemed like that's when all the conversations would happen. It always seemed like coffee, diners, conversation, they all just went together. So to me, it's the drink of sociability. How old were you when having your first cups of coffee with your grandfather?
I think I must have been around 11 or 12. Yeah, I think so. Definitely preteen, because once I hit sort of like teen years, it was still definitely cool to have coffee with him, but my associations with it expanded. But yeah, I think he got me started pretty early, I guess. I mean, I think they say you're not supposed to have too much caffeine before a certain age or it'll stunt your growth or something.
Oh, I was told that, you know, don't drink coffee, it'll stunt your growth. And here I am, 6'1".
I'm only 5'2¾", so maybe it worked on me and not on you.
I don't know. So maybe it's in my heritage, being Danish. That's about all we got is coffee and desserts, so.
Two of my favorite things, actually.
So. Ah, you're a dessert person.
Oh, man. I am definitely a dessert person.
When it comes to desserts, what do you gravitate towards? Is there a specific subgenre of dessert you go toward?
I find that desserts for me are very seasonal. Like, I love ice cream, but I really only want to eat it around, like, during baseball season, kind of, so that early April into, like, mid-February. Otherwise, I am all about the, like, the gooey baked things. Like, I love brownies and cookies. Cake is good, but that's not my go-to. That's like reserved for birthdays and like parties and stuff. But yeah, I'm a huge fan of baked goods, sometimes baked goods with ice cream. My go-to not this summer, but last summer was, I think I had a brownie sundae, like a fudgy brownie with vanilla ice cream and chocolate syrup and peanuts, like every night for like 2 months or something. It was ridiculous.
Like a lava cake type of brownie?
Yeah. Yeah, that is like heaven.
Oh, I can't argue with on that. I cannot. What about pies?
It's funny that you mentioned pies after you just mentioned diners, because the only time I eat pie is pretty much if we go to a diner. When I was living in Lincoln, Nebraska, and I'm sure it's a chain that's elsewhere, but I've not encountered it elsewhere, called, I think, the Village Inn. They were known for pies. And so we would often like go to a late movie with some friends, and then afterwards go and have coffee and pie and talk about the film and talk about whatever. And so that was pretty, I mean, that's almost primarily when I have pie, in which case I am not a fan of cream pies. I am a fan of fruit pies. But not cherry, because it's disgusting.
I can understand. I'm not a fruit pie person. I actually go more for the creams, but I will never turn down pumpkin pie for some reason.
Oh, well, pumpkin is its own special, like, all things pumpkin are almost all pumpkin things are delicious, I would say.
Yeah, it's become this big money pit the last couple of years. The pumpkin everything, pumpkin spice.
Yeah, well, the pumpkin beers are the only thing I really can't get on board with, actually. I've tried, like, 3 different breweries' pumpkin beers, and I'm just like, ugh. I don't know why. I mean, I'll eat pumpkin pie, pumpkin bread, pumpkin soup, pumpkin lattes. No pumpkin beer for me.
Gotta draw your line somewhere when it comes to pumpkin, I think.
Yeah, because otherwise, you know, you have to have standards. You can't just be for everything.
Pumpkin soap. Pumpkin. I don't know. It's getting insane. Like, I go to this, it's already begun. It's not even September yet.
Oh, I know. I saw this huge, like, Oktoberfest display at the grocery store last week, and I'm like, give me a break. Like, we were barely halfway through August.
Give me till September.
Exactly. And even, I would say, like, give me at least a week or so into September. I want the weather to start changing a little bit more so that I can actually feel like fall. Otherwise, it's like, makes me sad that it's still hot, but there are pumpkin things.
Yeah, give me till mid-September.
Exactly. And that way you can have your pumpkin latte while you eat your pumpkin pie and wear your pumpkin lotion. And it'll be, you know, like smoky outside. A little bit cool. Leaves will have begun to change color. That's when pumpkin tastes best.
If you start too early, it's like Halloween. If you start celebrating it too early, you will get burnt out on it. It's just like Christmas.
Yes, definitely. And Halloween is, you're mentioning all my favorite things. Halloween is my most favorite holiday, and it makes me very angry when they start putting out the Halloween stuff. Like now or in the first week of September. I want them to wait until the last week of September, preferably just like 3 to 5 days before October 1st, in which case that's the week like I'll go buy stuff because we do start decorating on October 1st. Halloween lasts the whole month for me.
1 month is fine. You know, I just say that I won't put up any Christmas decorations until Black Friday.
Yes.
Let me get through one holiday, then we'll focus.
Exactly. Yeah, that whole starting Black Friday, like turning Thanksgiving into Black Thursday or whatever. I forget what they were calling it, but that just made me so angry. I don't participate in those kinds of shopping, mostly because I'm like lazy and full of food. But like, don't get rid of Thanksgiving. I mean, you're basically... like Thanksgiving only gets like half of that day and then Christmas gets the other half because everyone's like punching each other for $50 flat screen TVs or something.
I would much rather, instead of going out at 9 o'clock on Thanksgiving night, I would much rather be, you know, on the couch with a blanket watching some mind-numbing TV.
Yes. I like to watch holiday movies on the holiday too. So we will sometimes we'll do it before dinner, but usually because, you know, sometimes you do the Thanksgiving dinner a little early so you can just like sit in your own food coma for the rest of the evening. And we'll do like the Peanuts Thanksgiving special, and there's like a Simpsons Thanksgiving special. There aren't too many Thanksgiving movies, though, unfortunately. So pickings are slim.
I can name only one, I think.
Which one are you thinking of?
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yes. Oh my God, I love that movie. I always forget that's a Thanksgiving movie. I think it's because it's so snowy. I always think it's Christmas, even though I know better than that because now I've lived in the Midwest and I know it snows in November. But I used to think it was a Christmas movie when I lived in California because I'm like, that's the only time it snows is on Christmas Day. That's what movies have taught me.
You started out in California?
I'm from the Central Valley, from Fresno, actually. My dad's family, my dad's dad's family goes back generations, a couple generations in California. And then dad's on my grandma, she's from Mexico City, and my grandfather's people were originally from, I think, northern Mexico. But so I lived there, I grew up there, lived there until my early 20s when I moved for school.
And that's how you came to Nebraska?
Yeah, actually, it took me to Indiana first, and then the PhD program brought me to Nebraska, and now a job took me to West Virginia.
So of all the places you've been then, you know, outside of California, because that's home, of all the places you've been to, where do you consider your favorite?
Oh, you know what? If you had asked me this question like 7 years ago, I would never thought to hear myself say this, but Lincoln, Nebraska was my favorite. When I applied, I only did it because my advisor had said like, you need to apply to 10 places. And I'm like, well, you know, I already did like 7 and those are the places that I would like to go. And she's like, I don't care, like do 10. So I'm like, all right. So I did a little more research and I was like, Nebraska. Like, I don't even know where that is on a map because Californians are notoriously California-centric, and I really had terrible geography up until like my mid-20 adult years when I had to figure out where I was driving to. So like, I had no conception of it. I applied, they offered, you know, I mean, this really great deal. They had really good faculty. They have this really like old program, and I got there and I was like, oh my God, I'm going to be living in like, I don't know, cornfields or something, which is, I was living in Indiana before that, so that was like living in cornfields. But Lincoln was like a really genuinely nice place to live. It had, like, people were friendly. I mean, it's definitely conservative, but because I was in the capital and it's a university town, there was like a ton of liberal enclaves. So you were sort of like, they actually had like gay bars and like farm to table restaurants and like hipster food and stuff like that, which, and cafes, which I appreciated. And people were just like, people were cool. And the prairie has its own kind of weird beauty, I think, that is not, I think part of it for me is that it looks like old Westerns, like old John Ford John Ford Westerns with like literal, what are those things that like travel across tumbleweeds. Like if you drive out into like the middle of Nebraska, there are literal tumbleweeds like going across the highway.
But you said that if I had asked you that question 7 years ago, you wouldn't have said Lincoln. Why not?
Because it never occurred to me that I would ever inhabit that part of the country. I think when I left for Indiana, I thought like, I'm just going to go right back to California after this. And I really liked the town I was living in when I was in Indiana. It was very small, but I really, really liked Indianapolis. I really liked, you know, being able to drive up to Chicago. And I was like, Chicago's a kick-ass city. And so I think had I been asked that question then, I would probably have said something like, here is okay because I can go to these big cities and do cool things and meet neat people. Whereas in Lincoln, I didn't actually have to leave the city to do cool things and meet cool people. I could do it there. But yeah, I've definitely ended up in spaces that I never really conceived of. I joke about like Californians being like self-centric, but it's pretty true. The state is so ginormous and it takes so long to get out of it that like you just don't think about other states and the options because, you know, like TV reflects California life and weather often. It often has that kind of like lack of an accent that you can find like in Hollywood. So it just never dawned on me that I would get to have these other experiences. Like that seemed like something so far removed from my reality at the time.
That was stuff in the movies down the street that they were shooting.
Yeah. And what's funny about moving is that I realized, because I thought everything looked like Southern California, because so much of it is shot in the hills of Southern California because they don't want to spend money on to do location shoots. So, right, like they build whatever inside some ginormous studio, or they just say, oh, we're in South Dakota, but really they're, you know, on the flattest hill they could find in like the north part of LA. But then when I actually drove cross country and I've actually gotten to see all these regions, I actually like really enjoy being like, that's not Nebraska. That's not South Dakota. That's Southern California. I know what that really looks like now. And my family thinks I'm obnoxious because when we watch movies, I'll like point those things out.
It's like, yeah, we're in New York. We're in upstate New York. There's a Joshua tree. Mm.
Yeah, exactly.
One of my favorite errors to point out is Nightmare on Elm Street 4. There's a scene that's supposed to be on a tropical Caribbean beach, and yet there are deciduous pine trees in the background. Not pine trees, but deciduous oak trees in the background in the tree line. I'm like, you shot this in North California, didn't you?
Ah, those cheaters. That's just cheap.
That's what you get for horror films. Shoot them on a small budget, make a lot of money off of them. Quick buck.
So. Yeah, that's true.
Do you watch a lot of movies?
I do. I really like movies. I really like going to movies. But we watch quite a bit at home. We don't really have cable, like traditional cable, so like all the channels. We really just do Netflix and Hulu and like Amazon Prime. And even though they're offering like a lot more television shows now and those things, but I mean, it was perfect because I'd be totally happy just watching movies all the time. I just went to see Straight Outta Compton on Saturday. which was really good. Well, I don't know if I'd say really good. It was good. It was entertaining.
Oh, it made a killing at the box office its opening weekend here for the, I think, the largest music biopic ever.
Really?
Yeah. It slaughtered the competition. Now, but I have my issues. I love NWA. Love their place in music. The cynic in me is like, I know what they did for this film. They removed so much to make it a more cinematic story.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They definitely did. Because Dr. Dre and Ice Cube had so much say in the script, they came off, I'm sure, like much more... they came off way better than they really were in real life. I mean, they leave out a lot of the issues, and they try to focus the first part of the movie on like artistic expression and like protest, which it was absolutely. But yeah, it's kind of a mess in part because they leave out so much and they kind of want to hit like the high notes without a lot of context in between.
And that's a problem, I think, with all rock biopics that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
It gets very messy. Like, I know they took out for this version, they remove everything about Dr. Dre attacking a female reporter.
Yes.
And that the whole misogyny angle of NWA is just wiped out from the film.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There are a few scenes that I think are actually shot almost for like comedic effect that show their sort of disregard of like women and female fans or groupies. And that's the closest you get. And I mean, their objectification of women in those scenes is clear, but the film is not treating it like objectification. It's treating it like these dumb hoes, like we're just gonna move on to something else now.
Oh, famous recording artist. They're just being young men, that's all.
Yeah, exactly.
Are there any rock biopics? Can you think of any rock biopics that are very accurate? I mean, we're not talking documentary, we're talking biopics.
Right. I actually, and I could be wrong about this, I think La Bamba it's definitely doctored, but I think that in terms of, like, I guess major things in his life, that movie does okay. And I love those biopics. Is in fact, I really like Walk Hard, which makes fun of all those music biopics. I feel like if you've watched a lot of them, that movie is like hilarious. Yeah, I'm not sure who comes closest.
La Bamba is very good, I think. I don't know if he kept having premonitions of planes crashing and
we don't know, but
it's a very well done, and the way they play the final scene of the flyaway, I thought was well done. You know, just the plane takes off into the darkness and cuts the next day.
Right.
We don't need to see the crash. We can get everything. But the other one I really enjoy and pretty good is Ray.
Oh, see, I have not seen that one yet. I don't know why, because I know about good reviews.
It leaves out some major stuff, but I got to give Jamie Foxx the credit. He deserved the Oscar for that. He played Charles to the bone.
Oh, that's awesome. And the writing, I mean, so the writing was pretty good. It didn't get, sometimes they get really like melodramatic rather than just dramatic.
Well, the key to that was they made a copy in Braille of the final script and had Ray Charles read it to approve it. And if he didn't like it, he was openly against it and said, no, take this scene out. I don't want this to be in there.
That's awesome.
And he did that just before he died, so that they got his approval on it. But anyway, aside from rock biopics, though, since you're a movie buff and everything, I'm not going to throw you on the spot and go, what's your favorite movie? Because none of us can who love movies.
Yeah.
What are some of the genres that you love to sit down with? Where do you gravitate toward when it comes to movies?
I'd say there are two primary genres three primary genres that I naturally gravitate to. One of them is that sort of, I'll start easy. I love superhero movies. I'll watch almost any superhero movie, though I am waiting for Fantastic Four to come on Netflix, which I'm pretty sure it will in like 2 weeks. It's getting such terrible reviews. But I really love all of those. And I'm not a huge, like, I'll watch almost anything, but I'm not a huge fan of like action films, but there's something about superhero movies, and most of my connections to comics are pretty old. Like a lot of the inner, I read comics and watched a lot of like comic book cartoons in the 90s. And so a lot of my references are still pretty solidly like, you know, early 90s to the early 2000s. So I'm not as like up on what's going on right now narratively, but I really love superhero movies. I like musicals, and I like those macabre sort of stop action films.
Like Tim Burton?
Yeah, like Tim Burton, but also like Paranorman and Coraline. What was the? There was another one that I think. That Day of the Dead film. What was it called? Book of Life. So I think Tim Burton, I mean, he is like the head honcho in terms of that kind of stuff. And Nightmare Before Christmas is actually one of my all-time, like, that's in my top five for sure. And the short film Vincent, I've watched like 9,000 times. But it makes me happy that there seemed to be this like lull where he was like the only game in town, and then he started to help produce and fund people who wanted to kind of take up that aesthetic. And so it seemed like for a little while it picked up a little steam, though I don't know what, I haven't really seen anything now like coming out in the next couple of years. But yeah, but that style.
Yeah, there's some movie about monsters that run a hotel.
Oh,
that's coming out.
That's Hotel Transylvania. I watched half of the first one and I was like, oh, I'm gonna vomit on this movie. It's so ridiculous. Like ridiculous, not fun ridiculous, but just like, so I don't know. It panders to...
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay,
Sarah. I quote one of the greatest movie critics of the 20th century. That's Tom Servo of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Right.
I wish I could slap this movie so hard.
Yes, most definitely. So I have zero intention of seeing the Hotel Transylvania movie.
Back to musicals for a second here. When you talk about musicals, are you talking more like the modern day jukebox type of musical, like Moulin Rouge? Or are we talking classical Rodgers and Hammerstein 50s and 60s?
Definitely more of the classical Rodgers and Hammerstein. Like Singing in the Rain is probably also in my, like, I'd say maybe my top 10 movies. I love the colors. I mean, especially when you can watch it in Technicolor. I mean, and it's supposed to be fantastic. I mean, the idea that everyone gets to sort of stop and sing and reflect and dance around, that really appeals to me. But then the use of the color in it, it makes it so surreal. But it's that kind of surreal that feels very comfortable, as opposed to a sort of like David Lynchian kind of surreal where you're like scared. But I'd say Singing in the Rain and just sort of all those classics like South Pacific and Oklahoma. And I did like that Madonna one. Was it Evita?
Yeah, Evita.
And this doesn't really count because the movie's okay. But I was to say, like, I love more modern musicals, like from the stage. Like I love Rent, and the film is okay. It does pretty well considering like how much older the original cast was when they decided to make the film.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings on the movie, but I love stage play.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, absolutely. I'm not entirely sure why they chose to do the movie so late. I'm assuming they just like wanted money, or they were trying to advertise for like another, like, I don't know, a revival for it, or if it had just been in the works for so long and finally got greenlighted.
If memory serves me right, it was a rights issue. I think De Niro actually owned the rights in the 90s on it. He was first to grab it, but I think he couldn't hold on to it, and property got something like that. It changed hands a number of times, and ultimately Chris Columbus was brought in to take it. So
oh.
I think it was a rights issue. I think the one I go back to, I have to say my favorite musical, and it's a great movie adaptation for the most part. Little Shop of Horrors.
Yes, how could I forget about that? Rick Moranis, he was the man.
Recently, the woman in that film who originated Audrey just did a revival where she played Audrey again.
Really?
I think she's in her 60s, but she went and did Audrey for a small run, and I forget who played Seymour. It's a famous name. But she came back to do Audrey one more time.
Huh. That is really cool. Yeah, I think that movie helped build my intense fear of dentistry, but I do love that movie and the idea of a plant that will eat you.
It's such a smart, clever musical. It's really subversive. But back to these other genres for a moment, because I'm curious. I love movies. And so with Macabre Stop Motion, do you have an affection for horror then, with your love of Halloween and all that?
Yes and no. I think that part of my... It's funny because, like, I hate haunted houses, and this will tie into, like, my relationship to horror films, because a lot of those haunted houses are so mean-spirited. Like, there was the last one I went in that I vowed, like, I am never going in a haunted house again, ever. They, like, not only did the, like, chainsaw next to your ear stuff, but, like, they would grab you. Like, this dude, you know, like, grabbed my arm and like freaked out. I mean, it was like a really traumatic experience, and they were sort of like, they ended up getting sued for sexually harassing women going through because they were grabbing women in inappropriate ways. But it's that mean-spiritedness, that not that I'm trying to scare you because fear is an integral part of the human experience, and it's something that in many ways I think we should embrace and understand how to work with and how to deal with, but it's just the sort of like, I want to mess you up. And so some of the horror films that have that mean-spiritedness in them, I don't really like. I'm fine with gratuitous violence. I'm fine with the blood and gore. That part doesn't really bother me. But I think that for me, the macabre stop-motion films are more, I think they're approaching death more than they're approaching fear. And that's one of the things that I appreciate. I'm very interested in this relationship with death as being something that we're like a lot closer to than we like to think. Whereas horror movies are about like, oh, I don't want this person to kill me, or I don't want to like be in pain or something like that. But a lot of these more macabre movies are more about a relationship with the afterlife and a relationship with spirits. And that's like Dia de los Muertos and Halloween. I think that's part of its appeal to me. I really like that, almost like a celebration of like death and an afterworld, whereas horror films are more about like trying to stay in this reality very solidly. Though I did very much like, was it Babadook? Is that what it's called?
The Babadong?
Yeah, whatever that movie was. That it was a horror, it was like a feminist horror film that came out.
The Badonkadonk, you know.
Yeah, right.
It's the only way I remember the title.
That one was good, but that one does the thing that I think these like macabre animated films do, which is it's very much about like an interaction, a relationship with death and spirits, rather than it is about like, I'm just going to scare the shit out of you.
Yeah, it's less about a psychopathic monster hacking up teenagers, classic slasher film style, versus more meditating on death in the afterlife.
Right. And I think one of my, even though I think a lot of horror films are doing this much, they're dealing with this much more consciously, one of the things I think never kept me more interested in slasher films was that really contentious relationship with women as objects of desire, and that when women have desire, they have to get cut down. like, oh, this woman's a slut, so she has to die in like the first 10 minutes of the movie. Or these girls go to a cabin with these boys to have sex, so they have to die. And the virginal one is the only one that can win out over the monster, the zombie, the whatever it is. Like, that part of it, unfortunately for me, I think, because I'm probably missing out on probably like good filmmaking, has kind of kept me from being more into that sort of genre or that aspect of like horror genre.
There's some interesting stuff with gender and slasher movies in not in the way of, oh, you know, she's a slut and must die. There's some I can recommend to look at.
Okay.
I can also recommend to you a couple of good films about the afterlife. Lesser known, like there's a great Japanese one called Afterlife.
Okay.
And it's a fascinating film where the basic concept is when you die, you go to a office building as the entranceway to wherever it is. And in this office building, you're told you can pick 1 minute of your memories from your time on Earth, and we will recreate that scene, film it, and give you a copy, and that's the only thing you can take into the afterlife, is this 1 minute from your time on Earth to remember it by.
Wow.
And so it's complicated when one of the office workers finds out a connection to one of the recently deceased that he has to that person without knowing it. But it's a really fascinating mental exercise. If you could take only one memory, 1 minute of your life to keep for eternity, but nothing else, you would remember nothing else about your time on Earth, what would you take?
Oh, man. That is an awesome premise. And so difficult. I wouldn't even know. I mean, I'm definitely interested in watching that. I'd love to see how the character grapples with what thing to keep. Because that seems like an impossible task. Almost want to remember nothing rather than like choose one thing.
What makes the film even tougher in some ways to think about is that many of the people, the small parts that they have who aren't the main characters, who get asked about the memories and recreated, were not actors. They were local people. They were asking, say, an 80-year-old man what his favorite memory was, and then they recreated it for him for the film.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's a stunning piece. Stunning piece. Up there, I haven't seen it in a long time either, Wings of Desire, the German film, that City of Angels was made on.
You know, okay.
But I'll give you other recommendations off the air, I'm sure.
Yeah, I would love that. Thank you. Yeah, it's nice to talk to another person who is also, actually, you know, I have to say, a shocking number of things that we both like. That's pretty cool. This discussion was supposed to happen.
That's the beauty of this show. We really do not know where we're going with anything. We just go. Whatever happens, happens.
Nice.
See, now you're in West Virginia. Yeah, you're teaching. Where are you teaching these days? Where are you at?
I'm teaching at Marshall University. You know that movie, We Are Marshall?
I know Marshall.
Okay.
I went to Southern Miss, same conference, football.
Oh, okay. So you are well aware.
I know of Marshall, not been there. I always picture Marshall as being like in the South somewhere, not West Virginia, though.
I don't know where I pictured West Virginia, but it's interesting because people here think of themselves as being part of the South, but they're so far east. That there's like a really weird dynamic but in different parts of the state. Like the part of the state that I'm in, which is in the tri-state area, so you can cross the Ohio River and one bridge you're in like Kentucky and the other bridge you're in Ohio. But people think, which neither, I think of Kentucky as being sort of southernish, but I definitely don't think of Ohio as being southern. But definitely West Virginia has this very interesting like state identity tension between like a southern like identity and a kind of and an eastern identity, I guess.
Is that what's appealing to you about West Virginia? Because I've heard many different things about what makes West Virginia so awesome.
Well, yeah, that I find fascinating because a lot of the work that I do in terms of, you know, like research and scholarship has to do with identity and performance of identity. So like gender performance, ethnic performance, and the ways in which people I've met who are from the area perform their preferred West Virginia identity is just like so far endlessly fascinating. It is also easily the most beautiful place I've ever lived. They, even Huntington, which is considered one of the, it's a small place, but it's considered one of the largest like metropolitan areas, which cracks me up. But they don't, and they don't clear everything like other states would. They try to like stick houses in the trees so that you have these places that where you'll have a neighborhood and there's almost like just patches of forest and mountain in the neighborhood. So when I look out like the window of the house we're renting, I mean, I just see all these trees and it's beautiful. So that would be the identity thing, and the geography are definitely the two things I have found like most appealing.
Do you do much outdoor stuff in West Virginia, like hiking or camping?
If you mean the universal you, then yes. If you mean you, me, I haven't done very much. I am very solidly a city person. I like going outside and I like being outside. Like I like sitting outside a cafe and having a croissant and a cup of coffee. And I like some hiking. Like we did go to, it's called New River Gorge. And it's a very doable hike. And it goes like it kind of, I forget what town you start in, but then it goes up into these cliffs where you can overlook a river and like historic train tracks. And I mean, it's just amazing. So, and which I really enjoyed. And I'd like to do that or something like that again, because apparently this is definitely a place. I mean, everyone keeps telling me that I need to go hiking in certain places and that I need to go whitewater rafting, and that those are like two of West Virginia's best outdoor activities.
Yeah, I hear that a lot, is that West Virginia is like an outdoor paradise, basically.
Yeah, I mean, definitely in terms of like, I think fishing and hiking and hunting and I guess rafting. I mean, those are all sort of like the major pastimes. They seem to be for local people I've talked to. I'm like, well, you know, while I'm here, what should I do? And those are the kinds of things that are always suggested.
That, and check out its wonderful arts and crafts scene.
Really?
Every time I pass through and stop at a visitor center, it's like lots of arts and craft brochures and samples of wares and such. Apparently it's got a big art scene up there.
You know, I think you're right. A lot of that is, I think, in between Charleston and Morgantown. Charleston's about an hour north of Huntington, which is where Marshall is. And then Morgantown is about, I think, 3.5 hours north and maybe a little bit more east. But there, and a friend of mine, her fiance owns this like up and coming thrift store in Thomas, which is apparently, which I keep wanting to get up there. It's also sort of north, but apparently they have this sort of like burgeoning music scene, arts and crafts scene. It's becoming this little like utopia for the arts. And so that's really exciting. But yeah, I think a lot of that is either happening up north of where I am, or I have somehow not stumbled on Huntington's treasure trove. So maybe I need to do more research.
Yeah, there's I'm told from people like Ken Robideau, who's been on the program before, that it's full of a lot of treasures that people wouldn't realize. So I've made mental note, West Virginia, state I must visit one of these days.
Yeah, I would highly recommend it. And it's nice when I'm like always excited when I hear people talk about like those treasure troves, because I really dislike when broad strokes are used to talk about a space as large as a state or a county. I mean, there's always something interesting in every space, I think.
Unless you're a teenager, in which case, no matter where you are, sucks.
Right. Yes, definitely.
Well, Sarah, we are almost out of time here on the program, and I'm shocked.
I know, we're fast.
I'm willing to bet, based on how we talked about, we could talk about movies for hours.
I would think so. I feel like we just scratched the surface.
Maybe we'll have to do that one of these days. We'll have to get together and just chat about movies and commiserate. Before we let you go, what you got coming up right now? Is there any new work coming out in the near future? What you got working on right now?
I have a few cool things that will be coming out. So it's interesting that we're talking today because yesterday was the 1 year birthday for my chapbook, All Day Talking. And I'm going to do a little like happy birthday special on my website where with purchase of the chapbook, like the first, I forget how many I have, but the first few people who get it will also get like a tote bag and like a haiku that I'll write in their copy. It's really exciting for me that it was exciting for me that it happens at all. This is my first collection and I can't believe a year has passed and it's just been such an awesome year. And I've met so many cool people through, you know, like touring for readings and stuff. I think a lot of the things that are coming up a few months out, but there's a really cool anthology, a political anthology that I'll have some work in. That's actually through Sundress Publications. I think it's called Political Punch. And then another anthology that's really exciting is one called Baird, and it's an anthology of breasts and bras through Long Falls Books. And it's got like a ton of like your heavy hitter poets, plus a lot of, you know, a lot of more up and comers or new people. And so I love that egalitarian aspect to the anthology, that those people are all like mixed together. But also I think both those are fascinating subjects, I mean, politics and breasts. So
sex and politics sell, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So Sarah, where can the folks find you online? They want to check out your work, get to know you a little bit here after they listen to the program.
Awesome. I have a website where I keep a blog. I try to blog at least once every couple weeks, but I've got a bunch of stuff on the site. It's www.sarahachavez.com. And then I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle, I think, is SA_Chavez7. And then I'm pretty easy to find on Facebook, too. I'm pro social media. I'm like, you want to be friends? Okay, awesome.
Hopefully some of our listeners will check out your work, and we will throw that link up on the website when it goes live and everything. And hopefully get you a little bit more notice here, because it has been awesome chatting with such an awesome person.
Thank you. You too. Awesome, awesome interviewer/conversationist.
Well, it's all due to the guest. I got nothing to do with it, honestly. So thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. We will talk to you soon, I'm sure. Take care.
You too.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.